Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Yost-Hammer, and I'm the director for the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana. I am delighted today to have two of my longtime colleagues and friends from the teaching of psychology world with me today. We've got Regan Gering and Beth Schwartz. Welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much.
Regan Gering is a social psychologist by training with research encompassing social, health, and pedagogical psychology. He has, tons and tons of articles that have been published in peer-reviewed journals. He's also co-authored or edited 15 books. He has recent books that are on thriving in academia and studying like a champ. He's also the founding co-editor of APA's journal, Scholarship of Teaching and Learning in Psychology. And notably, he co-chaired a national initiative through the American Psychological Association, Revamping General Psychology. He's a past president of the Society of Teaching of Psychology. He's a past president of PsychHI, the International Honor Society in Psychology. And he was a long-term faculty and administrator at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay before moving to Oregon State University and Corvallis in 2019. He's won more awards than I can list, notably the Charles L. Brewer Award for Distinguished Career in Teaching Psychology from the American Psychological Foundation. He's an expert in so many things, and I can't wait to talk to him today. Dr. Beth Schwartz is an associate director in the Office of Applied Psychology at the American Psychological Association, where her work focuses on applying psychological science to all kinds of things like human performance and well-being, workplace psychology, human technology interaction, climate change, the list goes on. Working alongside experts across the field of psychology, she focuses on connecting psychological science to these real world issues for a real world impact. But she started her career as a psychology professor at Randolph College and then served as provost at Heidelberg University and finally at provost at Endicott College, where she oversaw the division as chief academic officer. We met each other, and I should just say, Beth, also, you have a ton of publications and a ton of books, and that's kind of why we're here talking about it. It's one of those books. But the three of us met each other, oh my gosh, was it 2002, mm-hmm. When we were grading advanced placement psychology exams together. And then shortly after that, we got to know each other, and 17 years ago, I became director of this center, and you all had just published a book on the scholarship of teaching and learning, and I thought, who better to bring in as my very first guest speakers at Xavier? And so now, as the last podcast I'm doing, as I'm transitioning from the position, I thought, who better to end this conversation with than the two of you? I'm sorry that budget restraints didn't allow me to bring you to campus, but thank you for doing this podcast and welcome.
Wow. It's great to be here again 17 years later.
Yeah, what a thrill. What a thrill. And it's tough hearing that it was 17 years because it seems like it was just yesterday. And it's just so nice to keep talking and being able to still be talking to each other even after all those years, which is a thrill in itself.
Absolutely. And when you came, you spoke, you had just published your book on scholarship of teaching and learning, and you came and gave my faculty a ton of advice about how to do it, how to do it well, how to incorporate it into your life. And so I just kind of wanted to update that conversation today. So I thought we could start with now. Think about the advice you gave then or the book you wrote then, and what advice would you give differently now? And what advice has stayed the same over the 17 years? And I'm going to mute myself and let you all talk. I don't know who wants to go first. You all can figure that out.
Well, I'll say a few words and then I'll let Regan take on. I'll say that there's a lot that's the same, even though there is also things that we can identify as different. You know, we still want faculty to think about their teaching and their students' learning and ways to achieve their learning goals and the multidisciplinary approach of SOTL. The one thing that I think has grown in the last two decades is the need to provide evidence of learning, which has really been fortunate for centers of teaching and learning because of all the regional accreditors out there that are saying, okay, you need to give us clear assessment and measurements of the goals, teaching goals and learning goals that you're putting on your syllabus. So a lot of it's really remain the same, which I think is fortunate. And I think, though, that part of higher ed has helped SOTL work and centers like the ones that you and Regan run become even stronger, in part because we have a lot more understanding of learning science. We have many more definitive answers because SOTL has grown as a science. The field grows in lots of interesting different directions. Of course, we have, you know, generative AI technologies that 17 years ago, I don't think Regan and I would have even imagined. With the opportunities for online learning, it takes us in a whole new direction that we didn't touch upon in the book that we originally wrote. There's a much more greater conversation about accessibility that we didn't talk about. Of course, the need to consider diversity, equity, and inclusion was not something we discussed at that time. I do think that more graduate programs are preparing TAs. I'm hoping that there are more and more graduate programs that are including training on teaching more so than they did 17 years ago, which creates an instance where more faculty see the training as a norm. So you don't just have the folks from psychology and physics in your programs, but it's much more interdisciplinary than it used to be. So I think it's a wider audience. Just a couple more things before I hand the mic over to Regan, and that is, I think that there's more support for SOTL. I think it's recognized in the tenure and promotion process much more than it used to be. And coming from administration, I definitely saw that. And what I think has been great for me personally is that there are more people in those dean and provost roles that recognize that and then put resources in their budgets to provide the resources and staff needed to create that hub on college campuses where it's so important to really be that place where those conversations can take place. I think 20 years ago, 17 years ago, there was some assumptions that campuses that are very teaching focused, especially, that those conversations were taking place and that people already knew how to teach. And then there was the recognition that we really need to reflect more on our teaching. We really need to continue the development of our teaching. And those centers that have grown tremendously over the past 17 years, I think, are helping to make that much more of a common conversation on college campuses. I'll let Regan take over because I know that he has lots to add.
that's some really good stuff there, Beth. And I think there are a couple of different things, and I'll give you, it's more in terms of the details. One of the things I want to pick up on is mentioning that graduate programs and, you know, talking more about teaching and learning, I'm going to take that up a notch and say there are now PhD programs in the scholarship of teaching and learning. And if you go, where is that? Well, I'll tell you, Oregon State University. One of the big reasons I came to Oregon State was the fact that there was a strong teaching and learning. And the reality is we may be one of the few programs that have a PhD in scholarship of teaching and learning. So any grad students out there, or I should say any undergrads out there who are really interested in teaching and learning, you can go to grad school in places that explicitly focus on that. I think related to that is the notion that even though it may be called something different, for example, DBER, right, disciplinary-based educational research, this kind of work is happening a lot more. And not only is it happening a lot more, as Beth said, but it is happening. It's being done better. 10 years ago, I would be, as a reviewer, I would be sending papers back right away because it was almost like the submitters thought, oh, it's SOTL, it doesn't have to be robust. Mm-hmm. That's not the case anymore. And in fact, one classic example of how the scholarship of teaching and learning has grown is that there are now new journals on it. The mere fact that the American Psych Association launched a brand new journal on the scholarship of teaching and learning means that there's a market for it, because big corporations don't launch new journals if there's no money in it. So I love the fact that there's now SOTL in psychology, and that is also mirrored by a whole bunch of things in other directions. I want to bring on something very different, though, to the point. 17 years later, I think as much as the scholarship of teaching and learning has grown and become more robust, I think what we really have to face head on is that, and maybe I'm more cognizant of this after I moved to a center for teaching and learning, but one of the things I realized is with an increase in the scholarship of teaching and learning, or more, I should say, research on teaching and learning, what we saw moving further into the background is the actual scholarship of teaching. And by here, I mean capitalizing on the hard work that is teaching. And especially as a center director, I work so hard to help faculty demonstrate how the effective teaching methods that they use. It's more than just student evaluations. It should be self-reflection. It should be peer observation. It should be peer evaluation. These are all ways to show the hard work that is teaching. And when you go back to 1990 and Boyer's scholarship reconsidered, that actually was Boyer's intent. Boyer set out to say, just as important is the scholarship of application and integration and discovery, so too is the scholarship of teaching. And to quote Boyer, right, he said, demonstrate the hard work that is teaching. That was the origin of the scholarship of teaching that then became the scholarship of teaching and learning. And I think, unfortunately, and I'll say it, unfortunately, so many people, ourselves included, got so excited by doing research on teaching and learning that I don't think we paid enough attention to, but let's not forget documenting the hard work that is teaching. So I think I have become very, very cognizant of that after years as in the Center for Teaching and Learning, that sure, research on teaching and learning is important, but let's not forget documenting and celebrating the hard work that is teaching. So,
and faculty are so appreciative of centers that do exactly that. It's wonderful that you've been doing that.
Well, and what's really interesting is, when centers for as far as centers for teaching and learning go, there are about 25%, about 25% of the 4,313 American colleges and universities, about 25% have a center for teaching and learning of some sort, right? And out of those 20 to 25%, the bulk of them are doing, workshops and consultations and things like that. The smallest percent of them are fostering the scholarship of teaching and learning, that research on teaching and learning, And I think that's an interesting thing for me to note, because there have been some, there are some models of what centers for teaching and learning do. And it's pretty clear that serving as a hub, for getting people together and doing workshops and things like that is the bulk of what we do as centers. And the smallest part of what centers do is fostering that SOTL work, And I think part of that is because centers are trying to make sure that we keep that celebrating teaching front and center. So
I want to jump in here and add something. I should say that the name of your book that, we are kind of referring to when you all became kind of national experts in scholarship of teaching and learning is called Evidence-Based Tools and Techniques for University Teaching, Optimizing Teaching and Learning. Yeah. Was that right? Did I do that right? Did I do that? Optimizing Teaching and Learning. Okay. One title. All right. Thank you. And one thing that stuck out to me from your book that I still use in slides today is the triangle, the pyramid you have, right? Where you've got sincere teaching at the bottom, which is, you know, I'm doing the best I can because I've got heart and I've got intuition, I've got it. And then scholarly teaching, where I'm starting to, you know, read best practices or better practices and incorporate them. And then kind of what you're talking about being right at the top, that's doing kind of the research on this. So I really like the distinction between those scholarship of teaching, right? And Boyer's kind of initial thinking about it in the scholarship of teaching and learning. I want to do a quick follow-up, though, something, Beth, that you said, and then Regan, you referred to, which is kind of like one changes. I think, Beth, you called it evidence, right? Evidence of teaching and learning. And Regan, you were talking about just being more robust, right? And I'm thinking like what I've seen change in teaching journals, SOTL, SOTL, Scholarship Teaching and Learning journals over time, is we used to say students liked this, students reported that they learned, and so that would be publishable. And now, no, now you need this more evidence, right? More robust evidence, I think, is what we're talking about. Could you all speak on that, like how you've seen, like, so if I'm a new faculty member or a, you know, mid-career, whatever faculty member, and I want to get into this game, and I did this cool project, like what evidence do you need now to get published that you have you seen it change? What do we need now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as I had mentioned earlier, part of it is those regional accreditors that are coming to campuses. And a big question that they ask administrators that where's the evidence that students are learning, right? And that came at a time when cost of colleges went up a significant amount and the public was asking, what are we getting from going to these colleges and universities? So there was some, you know, political aspect to it there, but it made people really stop and think about, okay, how are we assessing it? Student evaluations was not doing it. Simply asking students questions that had to be some more clear methodology that was a valid assessment that learning took place from time A to time B that changed their way of thinking, changed the content that they knew. And, you know, from the pre-test to the post-test. So some of the, you know, some of the content of that original book was here's how you can do it, because not everybody has the social science background. So it was really just helping people think through how can I come up with a valid measure that shows that my students are learning. And of course, we talk about backward design and starting with the learning goals that you have, that I think people just at that point started to think about it within the SOTL world, just to come up with more than just students like this, right? To really come up with some scientific methods to use within the field of teaching and learning.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, it's really mirrored by everybody paying more attention to assessment in general. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, getting even more recent, one of the ways we got some lemonade from the lemons that were COVID is that more people paid attention to in-person classrooms, right? I think prior to 2000, a lot of the onus was on e-campus or on-campus classes, you know, and the big thing was, oh, are these online classes good, right? And yeah, the college, you know, We got the data that said, yes, a well-designed online class can be as good as anything else. Well, that's great. But and then COVID happened, and with emergency remote teaching, all of a sudden, administrators everywhere were saying, what's going on in these in-person classes, right? What's going on in these in-person classes? A lot more attention. And the upside to that was you suddenly saw these big gaps in assessment, right? Or these big shortcomings in how people were assessing. And I think that has greatly benefited the scholarship of teaching and learning, because all that fine-tuning of assessment, do I know my students are learning, really learning? Are they getting to those learning outcomes? Now a lot clearer, because so much more energy was paid post-COVID, right after 2000, I'll say. And I saw a lot more of that. And I think that has helped out dramatically, the attention, which has led to, I think, better reporting in the journals. And I think it's also tied to, you know, there's another dovetailing here, the new, you know, statistics and people getting more savvy. You know, one of my favorite examples is once upon a time, not in, you know, galaxy not too far, you know, far away, you'd say, all right, how many participants do we need? If you go at about 25 a cell, you're okay. But now we say power analysis. You know, what did your power analysis show? And it is rare to see an article, whether in on teaching or learning or on anything, where there's no power analysis. And I think that's very, very handy for us all to say, look, let's get a little bit better, you know. And of course, there are those other things that you can go, oh yeah, that made me think about p-hacking and the replication crisis. Mm-hmm. All these things have made us pay more close attention to data and data analysis and assessment. It's all coming together to help, I think, work on teaching and learning be done.
Excellent. And your book still has great ideas. I'm glad you mentioned that people who don't have a social science background who want to get into this and just haven't thought through this, there's still great examples of how to do these. You mentioned pre-test, post-test, and there's other things you can do. One question before I kind of get to my final question is, what about like the skeptics out there that still say the classroom is still a messy place, right? It's still a messy place. So you can isolate one variable to see if this helps learning or does it, this new technique, or does infusing AI, or, you know, whatever. But there's still so many variables, right? You can't control. This isn't a lab setting when you're really doing it in the classroom. But what do you say to them in 2024?
I'll start just because I'm coming from the Office of Applied Psychology at APA, where we truly believe that psychological science in part should be studied in the place where we're interested in applying it, right? So the classroom, if we're talking about, you know, teaching and learning, what better place to do it? And yes, I think a lot of psychology, regardless of the area, is messy, because we're talking about humans, we're talking about, you know, environments that are difficult to control. But there are techniques that you can use to try to eliminate all those extraneous variables or other influences as much as possible and still come out with some clear evidence of what has impacted student learning. And I think we see that, as Regan pointed out, the articles that are now being published in those sort of journals are much tighter. They really have considered the need to take into account those alternatives, explanations for the differences found between those, you know, students learning it this way or students learning this way. So I think that it's important to keep it in the classroom. And I think having it messy also kind of creates those additional questions of, okay, well, now we need to study it in this way, considering that this is what we saw in this classroom. So it just perpetuates the need to do more and more research.
Yeah, you know, and what I think is interesting is that something else I've seen in the last, I'm going to say 7 years or so, is the availability of more outlets where you can publish something that may not be statistically significant. So, you know, and I think that's really important because behavior is complex, and sometimes you may not find a straight out p less than 0.05, but there may still be some really valuable heuristic value from a study. And, you know, there are many journals that now have sort of proof of concept papers or virtual file drawer type of paper categories where as a researcher, you can get out some pilot work. You can get out some work where you may have tried to control for all those third variables and extraneous variables, but still not found something. But you can, you know, get somebody else thinking about it and making it better. And I think that's that flip side to the it is complex, but you know we need to see failure more. So that we can grow better and faster. Because if we don't see all the failures and we just see those significant p-value studies, well, that's really not reality, you know? And I think I like the fact that there are more areas where we go, look, we really tried this and we were robust and we controlled for everything and we still didn't find stuff, but maybe you can figure out why. And I think
I was going to add, the reverse has also been argued. Wait a minute, you studied this, but you didn't study in the classroom. How generalizable is this to the classroom, right? So I think that argument could be said as that's the reason why we're in the classroom, where it is a bit messy. But that's where the teaching takes place, in that classroom where it is a bit messy.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you all so much. Thank you so much. I do, we're running a little bit short on time here, but I do want to end with one last question, which is, okay, we looked back 17 years, kind of talked about how it's changed and advice you'd give now. What about the future? Like, you know, you all have worked in this and published in this and reviewed and edited and everything this for over two decades. So you've got some expertise here. What do you think for the future?
I think, you know, I literally before hopping onto this call, I was working on a grant for an interdisciplinary consortium. And, you know, Elizabeth, you mentioned AI, especially with AI in education, actually AI in everything. It's getting much harder to really understand it with siloed disciplinary backgrounds. And, you know, in our fields of psychology, and I know, you know, listeners will be from different areas, but even within psychology, there's a tendency for people to be social or cognitive or whatever. And even that has to change. But in studying teaching and learning, with especially with the advent of AI, you've got to have computer scientists at the table. You've got to have, you know, people at the table who are well-versed in different disciplinary backgrounds. And I think that's going to be really more important going ahead. You know, John Cacioppo said even psychology is really a hub science, right? It's that hub of a whole bunch of different disciplines. That's becoming even more important for studying teaching and learning as we see the focus on mental health, as we see the focus on safety and all those other things. We can't afford to keep those blinkers on and just go, are they getting the content? You know, we move from are they getting the content to are they getting the skills? But we've also got to think about, are they safe? How do their identities play a role? How are we inclusive? And for all of that, we need more people at the table from different disciplines. So that's my, you know, sense of where things are going and have to go.
Yeah, I would agree 100% and reiterate some of what I was saying earlier. First of all, to make it interdisciplinary does bring in diverse ways of thinking that can only help us understand teaching and learning better, but it also brings in the faculty from those areas more. I think 17 years ago, we saw a lot of social scientists sitting around the table and some natural scientists, but not necessarily folks from some other areas, whether it was languages or humanities. But I think by including more people from more disciplines, we'll actually get a greater audience for those workshops that are being held on campus to help faculty reflect more on their teaching and learning. And I know, obviously, as Regan said, AI, DEI, all of those things have to be taken into account to create a space where students enjoy being in that space, feel like they have a voice, feel like that they can speak their mind, and that they have the ability to learn in that accessible space, and that they understand where AI plays a role. I think that's the biggest question currently that's going to head into the next decade is for faculty, like, how do I use AI in my classroom? It's not going to be a good choice to just say you cannot use it because we know students will be using it. And we know that they'll be using it after they graduate. So why not help them understand in this context where they are right now as a student, how AI plays a role, and then they can learn how it will play a role in their careers afterwards.
Thank you so much. That could be a whole nother podcast conversation, couldn't it? Oh my goodness. Oh, y'all, thank you so, so much for talking with me today. I just want to say thank you from my personally and then from all the people at Xavier you've worked with. Yeah, you've been helping us for decades. So we are loving learning from you again. So thank you very much for giving me your time today.
You're welcome. It's great to reminisce about 17 years ago.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu.
That's cat.xula.edu.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.